Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Our guest this week, Michael Belisle, has written a controversial book on the origins of gun culture in the United States. It has set off a furor among gun control groups and those who oppose any such legislation. In a moment, we'll be talking with Belisle. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. When he stepped aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery on October 29, 1998, 77-year-old John Glenn became the oldest person to ever travel in space. The mission lasted 10 days, during which time Glenn participated in experiments designed to test the effects of space flight on the aging. Over 36 years earlier, a much younger John Glenn, an ex-Marine pilot of World War II and the Korean War, was selected for the first American orbital flight around the Earth. On February 20, 1962, Glenn roared into space and history aboard the space capsule Friendship 7 that took him around the planet three times at altitudes of up to 162 miles. Glenn retired from the space business in 1964 to enter private business and to pursue his interest in politics. Elected as U.S. Senator from Ohio in 1974 and re-elected three times thereafter, Glenn made an unsuccessful bid to become the 1984 Democratic presidential candidate. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Thomas Paine, author of Common Sense, the work that helped ignite the American Revolution, said, with prophetic irony, that the world is my country. Today, more than 180 years after they were dug up and carted off to England, Paine's skeletal remains, most of which are missing, appear to have migrated to all four corners of the world. Experts speculate that parts of Paine might still be in England, a rib might be in France, and a man in Australia claims he has Paine's skull. The Thomas Paine Historical Society is calling on historians and collectors around the world to assist in recovering the remains of their revered founding father. As soon as most or all of Paine is pieced together again, he will be laid to rest at the original burial site in New Rochelle, New York. The aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001 has brought in its wake concerns about whether American courts would repeat the kind of rulings that restricted the civil rights of Japanese Americans during World War II. Controversial measures proposed by the Bush administration, depriving immigrants detained in the terrorism investigations of the guarantee of a speedy court hearing, are fueling the debate. Critics say the proposals pose new dangers to immigrants, particularly to Arab Americans, that parallel the treatment of the Japanese in this country in the 1940s. Defenders of the Bush administration say that civil libertarians have overstated their cause for concern. This is Talking History.
There was a gun that won the West. There was a man among the best, the fastest gun or man alive. A lightning bolt when he used that Colt 45.
No country in the world has been more closely and persistently associated with guns and the personal possession of guns than the United States. It has long been assumed that America's love affair with firearms dates to their widespread presence and use at the nation's very founding. Historian Michael Belisle has looked into that assumption and come up with some interesting results. Here to talk with Belisle is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
It's something that most Americans know. In the beginning, there were guns. Guns were a superior technology that enabled colonists to conquer the Indians. Guns, found above virtually every fireplace, were used for hunting, self-defense, murder, and war. Guns won America's independence. But in one of the most acclaimed and controversial recent works of history, Michael Belisle, a professor at Emory University, argues that what most Americans know is simply not true. His book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture, has received the Bancroft Prize. Professor Belisle, welcome.
Thank you, Professor Nielsen.
Your book originated with your examination of some early probate records. What did you find in them, or I guess more precisely, what didn't you find in them that you expected to?
Well, I was working on a much more boring topic, which was sort of the economic culture of the frontier in early America, a comparative study. And probate records are wonderful for giving a sense of economic networks, what people actually owned at the time of their death. And it just sort of hit me one day that I'd been looking at thousands of these, and I was not seeing the word gun as often as I had been led to believe, because I'd always grown up on the notion that there was universal gun ownership. That's a phrase you read a lot in early America. So then I went back and tried to be more systematic, actually counting how many of these probate records had guns of some kind in them. And I found, again, it's a question of how much emphasis you want to put on a word, whether it's only or as much as, but only or as much as 15% of the probate records had firearms in them. So that led me to a whole series of other records, military records, militia records, business records, production records, trying to determine just how common guns were in early America.
They turned out to be not very common at all, which raises the question of why more Americans didn't have them in the colonial period and the early American, early national period.
Well, I mean, in a way, that's sort of asking why more Americans today don't own Lamborghinis and Ferraris. Firearms, particularly in the 18th century, were very expensive. They were difficult to acquire. There were not gun shops, for instance, in communities as there are today. There were no gun manufacturers in America prior to 1794, when the United States Congress established the National Armory at Springfield. All guns had to be imported. There was no one in the United States who could make a gun lock. So this, of course, drove the prices well up. In addition, of course, these guns were very difficult to use, difficult to maintain. They were inaccurate, with the exception of the rifle, which was a very rare item in colonial America. So it was there was no necessary reason why someone needed to own a firearm. It was a luxury which was associated with either the military or with the elite.
You make the point, for example, that they weren't even all that effective in hunting. Most Americans were farmers.
Yeah, I mean, first off, we have an image, and I had an image, that everyone who lived in early America would in the afternoon or in the early morning grab their rifle, and they always seemed to have a rifle, and go hunting. In fact, that is not the way it worked. Most of these people were farmers, and they were devoted to raising crops for their families. Hunting required that you basically leave the community, and I've read a lot of hunting accounts from the 18th and early 19th century. You had to get away from your community, away from the town, which is still the case if you want to go hunting, and go out into the woods and such. And that would take a lot of time and take you away from your work. Now, there were professional hunters in early America, and most famously, perhaps Ethan Allen was a professional hunter. But they used traps. Traps were much more efficient, and they didn't miss, and you didn't need to reload them, as it were. They were cheaper to use as well, and you could basically stay indoors much of the week and then just go check your traps on a specific day. So that's what professional hunters used.
We have an image also of guns being used in battle to subdue Indians and, of course, to help win the Revolutionary War. Yet your book makes the point over and over again that these weapons were extraordinarily ineffective and inaccurate.
Yeah, there was a great debate, of course, in military circles in the 17th and 18th centuries over whether or not they should even load firearms. Most military commanders felt that it was wiser to basically use a musket to fire a single round in order to hopefully frighten the enemy and then charge with bayonets. And the effectiveness of this method was proven at the Battle of Culloden in 1746, at the beginning of the year, against the Scots. And it was employed from that date through, at the very least, the Civil War, up until the Civil War, when the technology changed considerably. So, in fact, in terms of battle in the European and North American context, when armies were employed, the gun was not being used in order to necessarily kill the opponent, unless a bayonet was at the end. In terms of frontier warfare, the axe was the favorite weapon, or the knife, because this was close-in battle. And it's important to recall that after you fired, even the best-trained soldiers took 60 seconds to reload a musket, which would give an opponent a great deal of time to close in and stab one if they were armed with a knife or slash at you with an axe.
Almost from the very start, the state, the British government, later the American national government, seems to have regulated gun ownership and use.
Well, yes. I mean, to them that seemed obvious. They were conservative in a different way, non-libertarian conservative, these governments, including the colonial governments of America and the first government of the United States. What they feared most, of course, was social disruption. They understood that society was fragile and easily brought down, rendered into chaos by the dissatisfied. So in the case of colonial America, the biggest problem from the point of view of those in power was a slave population. I mean, we have to remember that more than 60% of South Carolina, for instance, was enslaved. So if these people could in any way gain access to firearms, they posed, it was thought, a real threat to social order. But there were others they feared, the Catholics, for instance, the Papists, as they were called. They also threatened to disrupt social order. The foreign-born, the workers in the early 19th century, the first labor unions were forbidden access by many states to firearms. And on occasion, even women, because women were known to shoot their husbands with small guns. And so there were, in the 1840s, there was a sort of spate of local laws forbidding women from carrying small firearms.
Most people, I think, assume that a well-armed and able militia, Minutemen, helped win America's independence. Did it?
Well, I mean, this is certainly open to debate among historians, the degree to which the militia played a positive role in the American Revolution. And it's at the moment, it's sort of a split decision that they were useful as auxiliaries. They were useful to back up the Continental Army. But the general assumption of most military historians of the American Revolution is that the Revolutionary War was won by the Continental Army and our French allies. It is certainly the case, as has been known for many years, that, as was known at the time, by the way, that 85% of the firearms used by American forces, both the Continental Army and the individual militias, came from Europe, from France and the Netherlands, and most of the remaining 15% came from England, captured on the field of battle or a gift of England during the 7 years of French and Indian War.
Given what you've learned about the number, the quantity of firearms in America, given what you've learned about its the militia's role, how should we understand the Second Amendment to the Constitution?
Oh, there's a huge debate. I don't know how we should understand it precisely. I mean, this is up to each individual reading the Second Amendment at one level. The Supreme Court has understood it in a certain way in several decisions, which is that the Second Amendment was about regulating the militia. After all, that's how it begins, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It seems to me that most scholars have focused on either the first part of that sentence or the latter part of that sentence, arguing either for a collective right through the state militia or an individual right where it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I think in the context in which the Second Amendment was framed, we need to understand the sentence as a whole, which is about the right of reliable citizens, as defined by the states, to hold firearms so they can serve in the militia. After all, you know, the people who were responsible for the passage of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights had lived through the American Revolution, and they knew what a close thing it was, and they knew how dependent the United States was on foreign arms and even foreign armies. After all, again, the French allies played such a key role. So Congress, immediately after approving the Second Amendment, the very next thing they did is they moved to arm the American militia. It was the United States government which, from the 1790s through the Civil War, supplied the vast majority of arms that were carried by the militia. And it was seen as a federal responsibility under Article 1, Section 8 to arm, train, and organize the militia of the United States.
Yes, that raises an interesting further point. One of the threads of your book, it seems to me, is that the government was often more interested in arming at least some of its citizens than the citizens themselves were in being armed.
That's absolutely true. And I mean, this, to me, this was one of the great surprises. I didn't see this talked about anywhere in the literature over the Second Amendment. You know, people today are fighting over whether they have an individual right to acquire any firearm they want. In the late 18th and most of the 19th century, the debate was over how can we get more guns to the reliable citizens. But you see, there was a real tension here for the American states and for the federal government, which is they wanted the militia to be well-armed. They wanted those people they saw as reliable and as bulwarks of the state to be able to defend the state against possible domestic insurrection. That's what they meant by the security of a free state. They were talking about its internal security. But on the other hand, they didn't want guns to be so readily available that those dangerous classes, the lower orders, the slaves, the free blacks, the Catholics, the foreign-born, could acquire these firearms. So the state laws, as well as the federal laws, tried to walk a balance. And one of the ways they tried to do it, for instance, was requiring that militia arms be stored in secure sites under guard so that they would not be seized, as Gabriel almost did in his rebellion in 1800. He was led a slave uprising. Mm-hmm.
The arming of America, by which I think we mean the arming of the general populace, far beyond what had happened before, seems to have occurred, as you present it, very, very quickly in the mid-19th century, in the space of a single generation. What happened to bring that about so suddenly?
Yeah, change does occur often very quickly. You just have to think of your own lifetime and look at how the computer has completely transformed our lives in the last 20 years. I think roughly the same sort of technological and productive change occurred in the years between the late 1840s and the late 1860s. And one way of expressing that is very simple, simple statistic. According to the U.S. Census of Manufacturers in 1800, 11,000 firearms were made in the United States outside of the federal armories. In 1860, that figure had risen to 50,000. 30,000 of those guns were made by Samuel Colt alone, by his company. But in 1865, 1.2 million guns were made just in the northern states of the United States. So there was a production leap in those years, those very few years. And in addition, a technological leap in terms of the quality of firearms, their size, their weight, their accuracy, and also, of course, what comes with increased production, lower prices. In addition, of course, there was the Civil War. The Civil War not only trained the great majority of American men how to use guns, but when the war is over, Congress gave Union veterans the right to take their guns home. So in a single step, they managed to train American men to use guns and then arm them.
Most books, most scholarly books, live very quiet lives.
That's right.
Yours has not, by any stretch of the imagination. It has received both very high praise, but also angry, even vituperative criticism. I wonder what you make of its reception and how you respond to your critics?
Well, I must admit the reception shocked me. I rather thought that my book, as my previous books, would hopefully attract some attention from my fellow scholars. But I thought maybe, actually, those people who are most interested in firearms would be interested, would be even fascinated by what I had uncovered, most particularly the federal efforts to arm individuals prior to the Civil War. But the negative response to my book began, in fact, 10 months before the book even appeared. There was denunciations of what they thought it was going to say. And since that time, I think a lot of criticisms of the book have been based on what people read on the web, rather, unfortunately, than what they read in my book. So, for instance, many places on the web, you can find the argument that my book states that America was a gun-free, and I'm quoting one of these statements right now, was a gun-free society prior to the Civil War. And that's utter nonsense. I never say anything even closely approaching that. But if one believes that's what the book is about, then of course one is going to think this is ridiculous and that the person who wrote it is in some way committing a fraud. But since I don't say it, it is not. I don't think it is a fair criticism. In the same way, when my book first appeared, there were many criticisms that I didn't address some primary examples of gun use. For instance, Daniel Morgan was raised many times. And anyone who looks in the index will see there are six references to Daniel Morgan covering eight pages, and that I happen to be, in fact, a great fan of Daniel Morgan as an historical figure, and I devote several pages to discussing why he's important. So I think there's a lot of misinformation that has been put out about this book, which has led people to imagine what it says and therefore to dislike it enormously. And I regret that.
We have very little time left. You do write that America's gun culture is an invented tradition, and that for there to be such a culture, there have to be not only guns, but a conviction that the ownership of guns serves some larger social purpose. In the brief moments we have, what social purpose have guns been seen to have?
Well, I think, again, a lot of this grows out of the Civil War. The Civil War did persuade the majority of Americans that guns were necessary either to secure freedom and preserve the Union or necessary to, in the struggle to preserve one's way of life, as we say down here in the South. I think that is still true. I think that many people feel strongly that their ownership of a firearm is a way of securing American liberty and a way of protecting their way of life.
Professor Belial, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Professor Nelson.
I've been visiting with Michael Belial, author of Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture.
That stands in the corner where the barrels are straight. I look out the window and over the gate. The big fat rabbits are jumping in the grass. Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast. Shotgun boogie. I done saw your track.
The Bush administration is prepared to withdraw unilaterally from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty so that it can go ahead with missile defense plans if no agreement is reached with Russia on the accord. Russia is opposed to both the U.S. plan and the dismantling of the 1972 treaty. Does history give us any insight into which country is right, which is the best path to take? Historian William Lambers thinks so.
This past July's successful missile defense test was a victory for George W. Bush, who sees such a system as critical to our national security interests. But buried by the debate over missile defense lies a smaller, less dramatic, but more vital national security measure. It is ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty bans all nuclear test explosions. Rejected in 1999 by the U.S. Senate, this treaty has been signed and ratified by Great Britain, France, and Russia. The Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations of the 1950s and 60s each sought a comprehensive ban on nuclear testing. Both President Eisenhower and President Kennedy realized that such a treaty was not, by itself, going to end the threat of nuclear weapons. However, they understood a test ban's significance toward achieving those ends. Their negotiations did produce a limited test ban treaty in 1963 with the Soviet Union, banning test explosions in outer space, underwater, and in the atmosphere. The limited test ban treaty came on the heels of the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 and years of frequent nuclear testing. Today, the possibility of nuclear warfare between the United States and Russia has diminished. But now with more nations possessing nuclear weapons and others on the brink, how can the United States defend itself in a world full of danger and uncertainty? One proposed way, which the Bush administration favors, is to build a missile defense system. But a better way to defend the United States from nuclear attack would be to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Failure to ratify the treaty leaves the United States less able to influence other nations to stop testing or developing nuclear weapons. Conducting nuclear test explosions escalates world tensions and increases proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. One only needs to look to Asia for an example of this. Three nations, India, Pakistan, and China, possess nuclear weapons. China's test explosions in the 1960s prompted India's development of nuclear weapons. Rivals India and Pakistan each conducted nuclear test explosions in 1998. The existing stockpile of nuclear weapons can be maintained without test explosions. Billions of dollars annually are invested in this program, called stockpile stewardship. But one cannot rely entirely upon military might to defend itself, whether it be building nuclear weapons or missile defense systems. To quote President Dwight D. Eisenhower, "Let no one think that the expenditure of vast sums for weapons and systems of defense can guarantee absolute safety for the cities and citizens of any nation. The awful arithmetic of the atomic bomb does not permit any such easy solution." It is a serious mistake not to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Without it, there can be no hope of ending the terror of nuclear weapons. By ratifying the treaty, the United States can take a step in the right direction towards securing peace for future generations.
You've been listening to William Lambers, author of Nuclear Weapons. Lambers' op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. You know, it's a tough town when even a lighthearted tour of this city's former mob hangouts is delayed because someone swiped a VCR used to help tell the tale. But that actually happened recently in Kansas City, Missouri, at our site of the week. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In Kansas City, you can take the gangster tour. Complete with guys in pinstripe suits and updated 1930s-style paddy wagons for checking out the famed mob sites and buildings around the city. The 90-minute history of organized crime in Kansas City was delayed recently when someone swiped the VCR used to tell some of the story. It starts with City Hall, built by famed political boss Tom Pendergrast. The tour continues on through Little Italy into Union Station, where your guide spins the tale of the pockmarked exterior, courtesy of bullets from the Union Station Massacre of 1933. The tour begins in caricature and ends that way when Officer O'Malley searches the vehicle and carts your guide off for bootlegging. The cost is $24, and there is a special $50 per person tour that ends at the Little Italy District restaurant Garazzo's, known for its authentic food and hearty portions.
Finally, turning to our segment Coming Attractions, the Library of Congress will open an exhibition commemorating the 100th anniversary of the birth of noted anthropologist Margaret Mead on November 30th. Margaret Mead, Human Nature and the Power of Culture will feature materials from the library's extensive Margaret Mead collection, one of the largest collections for any individual in the Library of Congress, which includes manuscripts, diaries, letters, field notes, drawings, prints, photographs, and sound recordings and films. The exhibit is designed to convey the scope of Mead's interests and accomplishments, as well as the range of responses to her work. It shows how Mead, born into a family of educators and homeschooled for much of her childhood, went on to study with some of the most prominent social scientists at Barnard College and Columbia University, and then became prominent herself for her field study of life among the residents of Papua New Guinea and Bali. Margaret Mead, Human Nature and the Power of Culture, which will be housed in the foyer of the Madison Building, is scheduled to be open from November 30th through May 31st, 2002. For further information, call the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.